Todd, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
We've played, as far as I can remember, all of your films, which have been released during my time. Carol, especially, a couple of years ago. Really, I mean, our audience has loved it.
Oh, I'm so happy.
He was out the door.
That's awesome.
I think you came maybe to do a Q&A with our, we did a 35mm presentation.
Oh, God, that was such a great night. And there were so many young people in the theater. Oh, yeah, I loved it. And my only regret is I have not yet had time to watch the print version of the film, and it's played at one at Metrograph in New York a couple of times. Yeah,
it's really, I mean, you've seen it, but it's such a beautiful image, and on 35mm with that flicker, and it was really delightful.
That's so
the
nice.
Digital is also very nice and very crisp, and the 16mm transfer is beautiful, but 35mm really kind of added something.
There's nothing like it.
We really went to town because we had the 35mm print for a couple of weeks exclusive, thanks to Studio Canal, which was great. And then we also did a retrospective, Todd Haynes Triple Bill, and we started with Safe, and then we did Far From Heaven, and then we did I'm Not There.
It was
great. I'd never seen Safe before. I was so pleased to be able to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, that's so great. So that was a print?
I think it was a digital copy.
I think it was a digital copy. There aren't a lot around.
It's very hard to find.
We were just trying to get one for Vienna, they love to show prints. And they did finally get one, but it took arm twisting.
Oh, really?
With Sony Pictures Classics in New York. So yeah, but I wasn't around for that screening.
Do films like Poison and Safe, do they come up a lot when you have a new film out, and do people talk to you about, you know, home-ent versions? Is there going to be a Blu-ray, that kind of thing?
They do. It depends on the film in discussion and its relevance to, it would come up in relation to having my lifelong career with Julianne Moore.
Yes.
And that just remarkable performance that just continues to kind of, distinguish her in my mind, because it's just such an almost unplayable part, and she's so fearless and brilliant. But it's so far been my only Criterion release is Safe. That they did a beautiful package of the film, and Julianne and I have a discussion afterwards. I think it's now 2 years old, something like that. It's fairly recent. Yeah.
I don't mean we have a very small version of Criterion in the UK. Sony have just started to put Criterion out. I think we've got like 20 titles, so maybe one day we'll have that.
Because they have to do different region versions for
everything.
Yes, like
different
everything.
Distributors have the rights, and they have the European rights to the US rights.
Yeah, so it's not about the region, it's really about the control.
Yes,
right.
But I think they're trying to absorb as many titles as possible, because most people, another distributor will happily lend them the title to put out on Criterion, because it's great.
Completely. No.
So I will look out for that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, they did a really great job.
I'm sure listeners will keep a close eye out on the Criterion UK page.
Yeah.
See. And yeah, like Carol for us played. I remember we were still playing it into the new year, and I think in the UK it came out in November or something. So
that's
legs, as they say.
That's so cool. Because these days that means a lot. It really does. That's not typical, and you don't expect it. Even for films that are well received critically and gain word of mouth, they just don't necessarily draw people to the theaters.
Absolutely. And there's so many films. So it's just hard for cinemas to actually house them for a long period of time.
Yeah.
What do you remember around that time around Carol? Because it was everywhere, especially during the awards, and the festival circuit played it so well. I think it was Cannes, and then it went all the way up to the Oscars. So a good year.
It did. You know, look, it was just great. It was a great experience for me. I think the thing that any director, I assume I'm not unlike other directors in this, that the one thing that you care about, and of course, when it happens to be Cannes, where you're first testing this out, is not if the film is going to, win prizes, yes, you want to get great reviews. And I've always had a really attentive critical community that's followed my work from the very beginning and has helped my work become known and supported distribution of my films in different countries, and which ultimately in turn draws actors to my projects and helps me get the next one made. But it's ultimately just that it connects with an audience. And when it happens to be Cannes, where you're debuting your film to the world for the first time, that's the first question and really the only question. So the season, the fall season, which of course becomes a sort of a campaign season for certain films, and Carol is one of them, and the interest of the distributor and all that, can distort the fact that really what you know, matters the most was happening and was being demonstrated by people's interest in the movie and love of the movie. And that, you know, there's been a kind of fan base growing for Carol that's it's funny about my films. You know, a lot of people in the film indie world know who I am, but a lot of my films have developed fan bases or followings that are distinct from film to film and don't necessarily cross to other films.
That's interesting.
And I can always tell when I'm doing a public event, like when some people are coming up to ask for an autograph or something, and which ones are the Velvet Goldmine fans, which ones are the I'm Not There fan. You know, it's not always the same group.
Yeah.
And Carol generated such, you know, obviously a lot of them among lesbians and queer people. And it was so, because, you know, my closest friends in life are gay women, and they have always been like they're like my family. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of did the movie for them, and then this happened as a result. So it's very gratifying.
That's fantastic, having an audience maybe in mind, but then actually seeing how it's magnified and explodes after you start showing it to the public.
Because I'm not a lesbian, you know. I wasn't even watching just like, you know, movies, lesbian films or films by lesbian directors as influence. I was really thinking of the love story in a broader sense, and just having it be about these two women. And I think that's made it universal, but also I think made it really specific as well. So
absolutely, I watched it. It's a great romance.
Yeah, you know,
it's one of the all time great cinematic romances in my eyes. And the fact it's two women, is interesting, but it's not the point of the film.
No, it doesn't keep you out of the movie. Yeah,
And so I definitely resonated with the characters just for the emotions.
That's awesome.
So Wonderstruck is now out in cinemas, and it feels like, you know, 2 years after Carol, and it's a delight to have. I mean, I'd love as many films as you're willing to make, but it feels like it's quite a quick turnaround. And Wonderstruck is a complicated film in terms of production. There's two different timelines, two different production challenges, I guess, two different film stocks and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was another ornate and challenging piece of work from a craftsmanship perspective. But I knew what was so great about it, even, and this was true for Carol and true for other films I made, but maybe hard to think of an example where it was more true than Wonderstruck, where all the creative partners and elements of film, of cinema, were asked to kind of step up. You know, it's not a film that's based on dialogue. Mm. It's so silent. It so works at the sort of elemental levels of film language and intercutting these two stories. And then, of course, it literally having one of the stories be reflecting film history itself. And these children who don't speak much through the film because they're deaf, but also they're alone and they're just navigating the city on their own. So they have no one to talk to. Mm. And I didn't even realize how little dialogue there is in the movie till I started watching cuts of it and was like, wow, it takes an hour for the spoken word to return in the film when the boys meet at the museum, and you don't really notice.
You're kind of just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's really, but it meant that the editing at Fonso Gonsalves's editing and the music, Carter Burwell's music, and Sandy Powell's costume design and Mark Friedberg's amazing production design were all necessary for the film to work. And that was great to just, you know, get all of these people I love working with and rely on.
It must be a subconscious thing though, but yeah, like they do all work and they do move the story forward. And like, I didn't even notice that the dialogue wasn't there for that long.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That means we were all doing our work, hopefully.
Absolutely. I particularly loved the sort of black and white silent movie homages throughout the film.
Like, yeah.
That must have been quite fun as someone who enjoys films to really kind of indulge.
It was so great, but you know, I don't know how. And I think back now at how many ways it could not have come out this way, but how much we rely on this performance of Millicent Simmons and this kid who had never acted before, who's deaf, who I'm so proud to say that we found in Utah in our little national search for kids to play the role. And she just, you kind of can't take your eyes off her. Mm. And she conducts the energy of that story with such you know, with such elegance and sort of intuitive power. It doesn't ever feel forced. It doesn't ever feel over gesticulated or overstated. And that's rare in professional film actors who've been working all their lives, let alone a kid who's never done this professionally, you know? So that is, it's great to always watch, to just watch a performance and sort of wonder at how unique.
I think she's, I mean, I would love to see her in more things because she's so wonderful.
She got another role and she's shooting it now, a John Krasinski movie.
Oh, fantastic.
In Syracuse, New York, which is sort of a miracle. It's a deaf kid who's, you know, that you don't get a lot of roles. Mm. But to have two films, like back to back, this close in time with her in the lead, it's pretty special.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you find working with just child actors in general, is that like a fun challenge, a different challenge to working with, you know, trained actors, grown-up actors?
It is, but I have to say, and maybe it's particularly this age where they're like 12, hovering around 12, they're so sophisticated and they're so kind of wise and that I didn't feel like I had to do anything that differently. You just, you know, they want to be spoken to with the respect and the sophistication and the nuance that you would with an adult. And they approached their job. They just wanted to do a really good job and then go hug their mom, you know? So it was just like, they really were just like working with adults, with professional, you know, grown-up actors. But there's something maybe even extra wise and sophisticated, particularly about boys before puberty hits and their minds. There's something clear-sighted about the way they see the world, and I think we'd be in really good hands if they ran things, as opposed to the two-year-olds that currently run the United States.
Extra years really count. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Big fans of the film, and looking forward to playing it in our cinemas later in the year. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listening to the Picture House podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening and see you next week.